Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from utility bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Remember the good old days of helicopter parents? Well, now they're on the ground, participating in a new extreme mode of parenting. It's called snow plowing. The act of removing every obstacle that could threaten their kids' path to success. In the wake of the admissions scandal, we're opening the lines asking you, at what point does overprotecting your kid become poisonous? Then it's two tales of one stadium. While the Patriots are the pride of Gillette, the New England Revolution played empty bleachers. Can Bob Kraft turn the team around once he's got his other problem out of the way? Sports Authority Trent Kuznarek joins us for that and more.
It's been 9 months since Tommy Chang resigned as superintendent of Boston Public Schools. At noon, we'll talk to Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell about what's at stake in the search for the next superintendent. All that is coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday. We're broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday from the Boston Public Library WGBH studio. Hello, Jim.
Hi there. You know what tomorrow is?
First day of spring.
That is correct.
Oh, my God. I can hear the rhapsodies coming already.
I'll save them for tomorrow.
The annual gushing.
You know, the college admissions scandal has done wonders to expose so much of what is wrong with our society, from the huge wealth inequities in America to the corruption that our institutions are susceptible to our neurotic obsession with getting into the right school. It's also exposing how deranged parenting has become. And there's a term for it, which I never heard until the New York Times the other day. It's called so great. It's called snow plowing. It's the act of parents removing every possible obstacle that could be in the way of their child succeeding. So instead of preparing them for the road ahead, they're paving the smoothest one possible. You know, long gone are the days of tough love, and if any of you tried to practice it, someone would probably call DSS. Today, extreme parenting means arranging your kids' social activities when they're in college. It means writing a note for your kid, excusing him or her if they procrastinated on their college thesis. The New York Times, there's so many great stories in this New York Times piece. New York Times reports how one college newcomer didn't know how to cope with the cafeteria fare because there was sauce on the food, so she went home, and it turns out her parents had protected her from encountering foods with sauce during her entire childhood. So we'll take your calls asking you, when does coddling your kid become corrosive? The number is 877-301-8970. If you're a product of snow plowing parents, please call. If you're a parent who feels pressure to adopt these parenting practices, please call. And if you're a teacher, are you witness to the hazards of all this? 877-301-8970. Of the multitude of stories in the New York Times piece, what's the one that you love the most?
Well, this is the one I love the most. The mother who once called to ask the person at the school to list the items on the school salad bar so mom could choose which items her daughter could eat for lunch.
How about the next story?
I mean, you've got to be kidding me.
That same woman who was the resident life something at Sarah Lawrence in Columbia not only tells that story in the New York Times, she tells a story of how her daughter or son, I don't know, her kid had a dispute over peanut butter.
That's right.
With the roommate.
Someone stole it.
So the mother got set up a video chat where she could resolve the dispute between the two kids. It is so sick. It is, and by the way, it's a perfect length of timing for the New York Times, obviously, was great because the obviously there's a line between snow plowing and criminal snow plowing, as we
That's
learned
right.
with Huffman and Laughlin and Wilson from Hyannisport, where you hang out, by the way, I should
That's
say.
That's right. He's one of my buddies.
Do you know him? I meant to ask you. Do you know that?
I don't.
Okay.
Near where
you and your sister have a house down there. In any case, it's so perfect because even before this Andrew Lelling press conference, did you not know that this was going on? And, you know, the fact that parents don't,
I didn't know the cheating was going on.
Cheating? No. I'm talking about snow plowing.
Oh, snow plowing.
Cheating.
Oh.
It is so incredible to me that a smart parent, I understand, believe me, because I'm a parent too, you want to protect your kid as much as you can. Do these people not understand how you're preparing your kid for nothing, for an ability to deal with nothing? if you protect them from everything when they're a kid?
I think you see an awful
lot. Not just a kid in college.
I think you see an awful lot of parents doing this. I think you see parents that are helping their kids in college. I think you see lots of people after their kids get out of college. Now, I do get the kids that are up to their ITs in debt from college and they can't afford anything, but you see people
What's
paying.
What's that got to do with this?
They call and help them get jobs. They help them. They line up their jobs. They tell them where they should go.
Would you call an employer? This is a story in the New York Times, too. Your kid has an internship with a particular employer, and they refuse to hire your kid for a permanent position, would you call the employer? By the way, even if I thought of that, I would argue that my kids would probably not talk to me for the rest of the decade.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even imagine what kind of person does
well,
this.
I mean, they're just so extreme. But I think there's a bunch of people who think it's fine to make their kids doctor's appointments when they're in their 20s to pay for the doctor's appointments. I don't know how many of my friends are paying for their kids' cell phones. They think there's nothing wrong with that, or they're helping to pay their rent, or they're not letting them grow up on their own, and they may not call their employer, but they call their employer to get the kid the job. I mean, there's a lot of that that goes on. I think it's everywhere.
And it is almost, in my estimation, not that I am a college. This is what you say all the time. You know, I'm not a psychologist. I don't have a counseling degree. You don't need a counseling degree to know that your kid has no chance if they never fall. You know, if they never stumble, if they never had bad experiences, if they don't have to figure how to maneuver around obstacles. By the way, I keep saying kid. It's not when they're kids. This is when they're in college and beyond.
And in their 20s.
It is sick. So the term, which I had never heard before, which we should say who coined it. Somebody in one of these books that's referenced here coined the term, and I love it. It's called snow plowing, which is sort of like helicopter parenting on steroids.
Clearing everything out of their path. I mean, they apparently sometimes call it lawn mowing as well as snow plowing. But snow plowing I love because it does. That's what it is. You clear the road. There's a great quote in here somewhere that says, here it is, that snowplow parents have it backward, one of these academics says. The point is to prepare the kid for the road instead of preparing the road for the kid. And I think it's true. I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that people have fewer children. I mean, maybe some people have 3 and 4 kids now, but almost nobody has 6 kids or 8 kids anymore. So I should say, if you had 6 kids, 8 kids, 10 kids, you know, if a couple of them wound up in the Suffolk County lockup, you still had the other 8 that would doing pretty well. You know, if one of them got into like a good school, the pressure was off. But if you've only got 2 kids, you've only got 3 kids, and you come from one of these neurotic suburbs, it's like you're not a good parent unless you get your kid into one of these great schools, which is why we ended up in this terrible cheating situation. And there's also the dynamic of the mothers who work versus the stay-at-home moms, because if you're staying home and putting all your focus on your kid and your kid doesn't succeed, then why the hell did you stay home? You know what I mean?
Can I read, before we take the calls, I mentioned this sauce conundrum. Can I read the actual paragraph from the New York Times story? By the way, it was written by Claire Kane Miller and Jonah Engel Bromwich, were the people who wrote this thing about snow plowing. Here's the deal. One kid didn't like to eat food with sauce. Her whole life, her parents had helped her avoid sauce, as I mentioned, but this is the key part. Calling friends before going to their houses for dinner. At college, she didn't know how to cope with the cafeteria options covered in sauce. So she essentially went home because she couldn't deal with the sauce dilemma at the college. 877-301-897. And by the way, we don't even mention the stories calling professors to dispute a grade that your kid got. I mean, it's just mortifying. It is mortifying.
Or this is another one too, that they will not just do the assignments for them, but they'll, if the place school is close enough, this is more high school obviously, but they'll take the assignment to school for them so that they don't, you know,
of course,
pay the price for getting the assignment. And then of course the kid is used to having the parents run the stuff to school.
But by the way, just in the spirit of full disclosure here, I did take both of my kids' final exams in college and no, because they were doing side jobs, and I didn't want them to miss work, so it was a little thing. It's not that. And by the way, I got straight A's on not everything, but most things. Mayor Lou in the hometown of Marjorie Egan, Fall River. You're first on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Hey, Mayor Lou.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
We're great. Thank you.
So I work in an area with a lot of women. I won't say where, and I love my coworkers. But first of all, my kids are all in their 20s, and I had 4 and 6 years, so I can't even, you know, I didn't have time to take sauce off or anything like that. But anyway, they will watch from their phones. Like, they can see, like, if they're at a dance class, there's a camera. They watch their dance class from the work. They, you know, they must call home, like, 50 times a day. And one of them cracked me up. She's got a kid in high school. And she called him up and she said, "Now, did you eat lunch?" And I'm thinking, if your kid's in high school and he doesn't know enough to eat lunch, you've got bigger problems than him eating lunch.
By the way, do these parent, do these coworkers of yours, Mary Lou, do you get the sense that they know they may be crossing a line but can't help themselves, or they just think this is how you are supposed to parent?
I think it's almost a like, it's an expectation now. You look like a bad parent if you're not smothering your kids.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a reaction to the fact that we were, as Marjorie knows, you went out the door and you came home when, you know, it got dark and
exactly.
It was time for dinner.
Street lights
and
went
I
on.
Don't know if it's a, yeah, I don't know if it's a reaction to that, but I see such a change, and I agree with you, Jim. We are raising a generation that will have no grit. They have the slightest little, you know, bend in the road, and they can't cope because we've constantly, you know, paved that way.
By the way, and let me just say on the sauce front, because my mother, to her credit, a single mother, she never protected me from sauce. I was able by 18 years old to eat sauce by myself at the University of Pennsylvania. So it worked out for me. Mary Lou, thank you for your call. You know, listen to these statistics. Now, these numbers may sound low to some people. Again, thanks to the New York Times. 11% of parents surveyed said they would contact their child's employer if their child had an issue. 8% contacted a college professor or administrator about their child's grades or problem they were having. I mean, how would your kids react if you had done that when your kids were in college?
I think they would be ready to kill me. But, you know, this Katie emails about something that I saw a lot when my kids were small. And she talks about parents trying to have their kids' elementary school teachers change because they heard they're mean. I didn't hear it necessarily because they were mean, because they just didn't think they were as good as a teacher in the other room. Mm-hmm. That was like a big thing, trying to change your kid's teacher, and the principal was always fighting against it. But just to show that not everybody is concerned about being a snowplow parent, here's an email from Barry who says, my kids would accuse me of plowing the snowbank up against their car and leaving it for them to shovel out.
That's pretty good.
So,
you know, can I ask you about a chicken and egg thing, if I may, for a second? You and I are both remarking on a piece we read that in the, I think it was the 1950s, 80% of kids would make more than their parents. In the 1980s, I think it was 60%. Now it's an 50-50 kind of proposition. So
I think it's in the 1980s. If you were born in the 1980s, 60%. You're probably not going to make more than your parents.
No, I think it's whatever it was. So in current times. But it's gotten less and less. So is the parents' overprotection a function of that because they're worried their kids aren't going to do as well as they did as compared to their parents? Or is it a result of how they overprotect them? The reason their kids don't succeed as much as prior generations' kids did is because they're so coddled that they have no idea how to do anything, which is, you know what I mean?
I don't know. That's a very good question.
It is?
I suspect this is going on more in the leafy suburbs than it is in...
Well, they say it's more of a privileged parent kind of thing because they can and because they're
clueless.
You know what
they say? You know, the nickname is, you know, the MBAs turn PTAs.
No.
The women who get their MBAs and they're really high power and they're really smart and they have these great careers and they decide they want to stay home and raise their kids. So all the focus goes from their career out in the world to their career in the school. And... they're relentless, Jim.
And by the way, again, in my own defense, when my mother moved into my dorm room at Penn, I threw her out immediately. So wasn't doing that kind of crap.
But little Jimmy got left alone all the time. You were alone all day and all night.
Well, because she had three jobs. I mean, I'm serious now.
So
she had three jobs.
So she wasn't really snow plowing.
No, she I mean, not only she wasn't. She couldn't. I mean, she had.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
she
did bring that
care
extra
of both of us.
Piece of salami every night in your
sandwich. She did. We don't have to mention that again, Marjorie. The extra slices of salami on top of this.
And there were already
sandwich.
Five slices in there to
but
begin
let me
with.
Tell you, and also the beauty, because obviously she was an expert in nutrition, because having a thick Hebrew National salami sandwich, literally as you're about to nod out at night is really, it's really the way to go. Randy in Lakeville, you're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hey, guys. First time caller. Ooh. Love the show.
Thank you very much. What's up?
Hey, so you turn the stove on. You tell your kids, don't touch the stove. It's hot. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? They're going to want to touch the stove, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I say let them. It's the only way they learn.
Well, that is, I'm not sure everybody would go that far. I think in my house, the answer was you tell them once. And then if they touch it and they get burnt, they're probably going to know better what to do going forward than they were based on the parents' admonition. Do you know what I mean? But I agree. You can't protect them. I was going to say a victim. How were you raised, Randy, vis-a-vis your parents' protectiveness, if that's a word?
They told me not to climb trees. I climbed trees until I fell out of one, and I learned my lesson.
I guess
that's parenting.
I think it is too.
Okay, that's Randy's.
Randy, thanks for your first call. We appreciate it. Do it again soon.
Here's the anecdote. The story begins with is from Nicole Eisenberg.
Oh, this is a good one.
She talks about how one of her sons wanted to be a star of stage and screen, so he took voice, dance, drama, attended this fancy stage door manor summer camp for 6 years, but was anxious, or she was anxious, that might not be enough to get him into the best performing arts programs. So they started this charity that helped raise more than $250,000. And she said that, you know, they asked for sponsors, and she considered donating big time to the college of his choice because there's no amount of money we could have paid to have him get in, as she said, because her father-in-law asked. That's how she knows that there's no amount of money they could have paid to get him in. But anyway, she talks about how this kid applied to 26 schools, and that she had been working on his applications, in one sense, since the kid was 3 years old. She took him to 20 auditions for musical theater, but she says she didn't do it with him. She did it with him, but she didn't do it for him. Now, does that seem
excessive to you? No, wait a second.
The
pathetic, I think you're missing the point here. Her defense of herself, mm-hmm. if I read this correctly, is when she said she took him to all these auditions, she said, but he came along.
Right.
Yeah, well, he was the one auditioning, not you. So it's not exactly a great...
She said she was not the helicopter parent. She was the co-pilot.
Yeah. You know what she is?
What?
A dope is what she is. 877-301-8970. By the way, the reason we're doing this topic beyond the college admission scam is I just love using the term snowplowing parent. It is so, you remember how much we loved when we first heard, we were on the air at the other station, we first heard the term helicopter parent, and how much we fell in love with it. This one is if anything captures the image of what these parents are, it is this, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, you know what the other thing is, too, and I think it's not really parents' fault, is that you get in these situations where, especially with athletic things, like if your kid doesn't start playing baseball at 6 years old, it's all over. It's too late. You know, if he's not mm-hmm. a star by 8 years old, forget it. And it's the same thing, I think, with a lot of these other outside the schoolroom endeavors. I mean, that people start taking piano lessons at 5 years mm-hmm. old or 4 years old or 3 years old, and they start playing in all these AAU teams when they're really young. And it's like if you don't do it, you know, forget it. You're never going to get into any college, never mind into the college you want to with an athletic scholarship. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. But, you know, but they're different gradations. I mean, there's a scale of helpfulness and non-helpfulness, and this is the extreme. And by the way, you don't have to cross into criminal activity like all these people allegedly did, according to our U.S. attorney here. But it's really grotesque. You should read the piece. 877-301-8970. You got to take a break.
We do have to take a break. We're mm-hmm. talking
That's
about snow plowing parents. What are those people? Those are people who clear the road for their children so there will be no obstacles
ever
in front of them for their entire life. It's a little extreme. We're asking you if you've heard of it, if you do it, or if you're a kid, do mom and dad do it? You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Well, Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the college admissions scandal, or at least that's the jumping off point, and how it's exposed how deranged parenting has become, the lengths that parents are going to do to make sure their kids have an easy path to success. We're asking you about what some authors have termed perfectly snow plowing parents. How'd you define that again? By clearing every obstacle?
Clearing the road so there's no obstacles forever in front of your...
So your kid is prepared for nothing, essentially to prepare to deal with no crisis, no obstacle, no nothing, because you've done it all for... And by the way, I keep saying kid, I got to stop that. This story is about kids into college and beyond into the workplace.
Yeah, when they're overly dependent on their parents, I guess is the main thing. Expecting mom and dad to do everything for them, including waking them up in the morning to make sure they don't miss going to class when they're in college.
I may have sent a text from time to time. I cannot tell a lie. I'm not sure if I did or not.
Listen to this. This is from Jonathan. He says the issue of snowplow parents exists exclusively among the top 10% of suburban white Americans. It's not psychologically good for either kids or parents, but it's rational. These are the children who go to top colleges and get the top jobs that keep them in the small slice of Americans who benefit from economic growth. The parents understand the risks of failure are too high in this age of rapidly expanding inequality. And he's got a point.
Well, it's speaking of that, I'm not going to name who the politician is because we have talked a lot about somebody we used to interview a lot who's very prominent. And we talked about how he, who was very wealthy, incredibly prominent, was an example of somebody, and I think this is what the email was talking about, arrested development because, again, he never had to confront anything difficult. Yeah, I'll tell you later. Don't ask on the
air. Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
And he's no longer in state, if that helps you in some ways. You see what the impact is. I don't care if you're a wealthy, and I know it's much more likely in privileged white families, suburban families, for this to happen. But the blindness is staggering. I understand the instinct on the part of every decent parent to protect their kid however they can. But this is just so insane. Can you repeat the favorite one again? What did the woman do with the salad bar? This is one of my favorites.
Oh, this is my favorite, yeah. This woman, I think she was at Sarah Lawrence, which is this little tiny school in Bronxville, New York, I think. That she said a mother once called to ask her to list the items on the school salad bar so she could choose what her daughter should eat for lunch. Mm. She's the same administrator who said another parent intervened over video chat to resolve a dispute with a roommate over stolen peanut butter.
Now, by the way, I've called Whole Foods to ask what is available in the salad bar, but I do it for myself. Yeah. I don't have a parent or anybody else doing it. Wally in Cape Cod, you're on Boston Public Radio with me, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Nice to talk with you.
You too.
This has been a favorite conversation in our family since our kids were little. We would call it infantilizing our children, which we believe is really much more about parents having their needs to stay connected to their kids.
Absolutely right.
But I wanted to share a story about our kids and our child raising. When our kids turned 12, both of them, my wife would say to them, from this day on, you're doing your own laundry. I'm going to teach you how. And if you ever wake up in the morning and you don't have clean clothes, it won't be my fault.
Oof,
and
tough
they did
love.
It ever since. Now, when our son went to college, he was a freshman, and he was in the laundromat at the basement of the dorm watching a fellow student take all of his laundry, his lights and darks, and throw them into the machine with a big gob of detergent and put the coins in and start the machine, at which point he said to the kid, I'm sorry, but that's the dryer.
That's a good one. I hope that's true, Wally. That's a great story.
Well, Wally, that's one of the
Wally,
things.
Wally, you did it right. Thanks for the call.
That's one of the things I mentioned in this story. Kids get into college unable to do their own laundry. They don't know how to do it. I mean, it's just crazy. And they talk about. I find this unbelievable.
What's
but
that?
Apparently, one of these administrators said she was the former dean of freshmen at Stanford. She said that she saw students rely on their parents to set up play dates with people in their dorm.
In the dorm, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I believe that. Can you imagine?
Yeah, my mother tried. No one wanted to have a play date. So I know I'm airing a lot of dirty laundry here.
You are daring a dirty laundry. Poor Mrs. Browdy. Little does she know. 877-301-8970.
Have you seen...
Have you seen snow plowing parents? Do you want to admit if you are a snow plowing parent? Were your parents snow plowing parents? Are they still? I mean, By the way,
you have described, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to damage your relationship with your friends. When your kids were younger, there are parents who I could name if I was in that kind of mood who you mentioned to me who could have been in this article.
Well,
no?
It's a classic. It's neurotic Brookline where everybody's kids go to Harvard. You know, you used to go to those PTA meetings in high school, and I'd be so nervous by the time I get over. I felt like I had to go home and have three martinis to calm down. Everybody's hysterical. And again, I don't know if it's – maybe it's as the emailer just said, it's because of income inequality, and they're worried that if kids don't go to Harvard, they're not going to have a life. But I think it's also because we are the ones that chose. I mean, really, when you think about birth control, it was basically only in the 70s it was widespread.
And I think it's a wonderful point.
The 70s is when you could decide, you're going to have your children. We're trying to have children. We're going to create our families, opposed to having all these children just kind of thrust upon you and let the chips fall where they may.
But to add to that, I know it's not an original thought, but I don't have data to confirm this, but don't you agree with the notion that more often than not, this obsession with clearing the path for your kid is about you? It's not about that. I mean, I said this when we heard
competing.
About the admissions scandal thing. Well, my guess is that I don't remember how many parents are on that list. The vast majority, I'm guess, were doing it for them and for their reputation with their fellow parents, their peers, than they were for their kids.
But I also think, and I felt this a lot as a woman who worked full time when my kids were little, you felt like you had to show that even though you weren't home with your kids, that they were not suffering, that they were getting those opportunities, and you weren't. And now I think so few women can afford to stay home, but there were more who did it, I guess.
So wait a second. So let's just stay with this one more second before we get back to the calls. If I sat down with 10 parents we just picked on the street and said, okay, with your intervention, you can get your kid into a really good school in Boston. Without your intervention, your kid's going to get into a B-plus school. Which is your kid going to feel better about and do better prospectively after? The you getting them in or they're getting themselves into the B-plus? Wouldn't everyone know that the answer is let the kid succeed on his or her own merits? If they need some advice, give it to them. But don't do it for them, no?
Well, I mean, what is all these expensive SAT prep courses about? What is all these?
By the way, other than the inequity, I don't have a huge, I mean, that guy, I remember the teacher from Beverly the other day, public schools should provide it across the board, at least some base level. But I can't tell you, you know, it's sort of like, who was the one Potter Stewart said, the Supreme Court Justice, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. I think I know what's okay to do to help prepare your kid for difficult things as opposed to doing the difficult thing for them. And I sort of feel if you can help your kid do better on a test, then maybe without breaking the law and ethics and rules and stuff, that I'm sort of okay with. What I'm not okay with is a poor kid who's sitting next to my kid in class, obviously doesn't have the same opportunity.
How many people with means do you think let the college coach, if not write, practically write their kid's college essay?
No, you're probably right. You're probably right. I'm not fine with. Dave in a car, you're on Boston Public Radio at the Boston Public Library. Hi there.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Excellent.
So I have a kind of a different twist on this, I think.
Sure.
So I'm 44 years old. My entire life, my parents took the tack that my teachers were always right and I was always wrong. They were kind of old school like that. And I'd go a step further and say they think I'm stupid. But a couple of years ago, I had a rough time at work, and I was telling my mom about this run-in I had with my boss.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom, who always thought I was a moron, said, "What's her phone number? I'm calling her right now."
Oh, my God.
So I don't think that it ends.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And this is, she had never expressed any kind of.
How old were you? How old were you at this point?
Oh, I was like 41.
No, you were not. You were not.
I am not kidding.
And what'd you say to your mother?
I said, "You can't have her phone number. You're not calling my boss." And she's like, "Okay, fine. I won't call your boss." And unfortunately for me, I worked at the kind of place where my boss's phone number could easily be found online.
Don't say she called.
So I had to, like, you know, try to make sure she didn't do that kind of thing. But I'm just saying that, you know, sometimes parents just get a little nutty.
Are you a parent, Dave?
I am. My wife and I have two boys. Yeah.
And how are you dealing with them? You about to call their employer or their teacher or whatever? How old are they?
Well, Henry's going to get his first job. He's just about to be four, but we're very excited about it. But,
okay, yeah. So we'll wait. Call us back in a couple of years. Dave, thanks. We have room for one more. Aslan in Arlington, you're going to finish us off on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Oh, I can't believe it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm not – I don't have any kids, so I can't really think on the perspective of, like, parents and stuff, but – what I feel so terrible about is the ripple effects this has on, like, hardworking students who are going to just say the rich get away with it anyways and just act as such a demotivation for them, you know. The justice for this needs to be swift and public, because the more you show hardworking kids you can't get away with this, I feel like the harder they're going to work.
You mean vis-a-vis the college admission thing? I totally agree with you. I'm hoping that every parent is going to be scared straight as a result of this, so that the kids you're concerned about, Aslan, and I couldn't agree with you more, don't feel like there's no point, because those who can afford to buy good things will just buy them. Aslan, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Boy, I don't have time to read all the emails, but there's a lot of them talking about this kind of thing being rampant. Somebody says a good friend worked HR and had to field angry calls from a very big financial firm in Boston when their kid didn't get a raise after the 3-month review. They got many calls. So, I mean, there's a lot of this going on is what the bottom line is, Jim. Anyway, we're done with that, because we're going to talk about sports and sports-related issues coming up with Trenny Kuznarek. Up Bob's Crafts, other problem. He's got the problem down with the women in Florida. But
He's
also got a problem with his soccer team, the New England Revolution. We're going to talk about that and more next with Trenny Kuznarek. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brown. She's Marjorie Egan. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Join us to take on the headlines at the intersection of sports and society. And today it's a Men Behaving Badly edition. It's Trenny Kuznarek. Trenny's an anchor and reporter, for NBC Sports Boston, a BPR contributor. Trenny, it's nice to see you.
It's always a Men Behaving Badly edition, isn't it? I feel like that's pretty much all we ever talk about on this show.
Well, that's right. It's redundant. You're right.
But this next story is really not men behaving badly.
We'll get to
It's talking about two Red Sox players who quite courageously opened up about their mental health issues to you. So tell us about it.
Yeah, in fairness, I wasn't like the first person they spilled their guts to. Brian Johnson, who is a pitcher for the Red Sox, he most likely will break camp with the team, the major league team, as a guy coming out of the bullpen or like a long reliever. And Brock Holt, I think most people, if you're familiar with the two, you're probably more familiar with Brock Holt. Very charismatic, blonde hair, blue eyes. His son Griffin is almost as big of a star as he is. Very involved in the Jimmy Fund, and he's like a super utility guy, right? So he can play all over the infield, but is going to play second base a lot until Dustin Pedroia comes back. But both guys, over the last year and a half or 2 years, have opened up about their mental health issues. For Brian Johnson, I think his, for lack of a better way to describe it, was a little more severe. He had severe anxiety that kind of crept up coming off of an injury and just performance issues. And that anxiety quickly turned to a very deep depression. And Brock Holt told me that he always felt like he had sort of an underlying anxiety, but sort of a trifecta of issues exacerbated that. So he suffered a concussion in 2016, missed most a chunk of the 2016 season and almost all of the 2017 season trying to come back from this. In December, I believe, of 2016, his wife, Lakin, gave birth to their son, Griffin. And there were just some issues when he was immediately delivered, and he had to be whisked away to the NICU, which caused Brock to have a panic attack. And around this time, he also lost an uncle to a heart attack very suddenly. All three of those things, the confluence of the three, really made him hyper aware of the anxiety that had always been underlying, but had sort of surfaced, and he started realizing in other ways. But both, I have to give a lot of credit to. There's still a huge stigma around men in particular, I think, talking about mental health issues. And both guys really feel passionately and want to talk about it, are very candid. Brock and I talked for almost a half an hour. about it, and both really open, and they want, and it's funny because they're like, I'm not necessarily even here to help other people. I just think I want to talk about it, and I don't think we should be quiet about it, and it helps me to talk about it, which is great to hear.
You know, by the way, we've said this a thousand times, but for those who are new to the show or new to trending on the show, I didn't know you when I first read about you. It was Kevin Paul DuPont who wrote the piece about your issue, your mental health issues, which I thought was incredibly courageous. Why do these guys decide? I understand what you just said because it helps them, and I admire that, but there's got to be more. This is tough, it seems to me. Why do they decide to talk to people like you in the public about this?
I think for me personally, when
your piece is great, by the way. I should have said
it. It is great.
You can read it on NBCSportsBoston.com, or you can download the My Teams app and watch it there, where you can also stream Celtics games presented by Nissan.
God, I'm sorry. Why do they do this?
I think when I asked them to do it, my pitch to them was, hey, I know you guys have both talked about what you've been through before, but I'd like to talk more about exactly what you were feeling, articulate that for people, but also talk about why it's important to talk about it publicly. And, you know, Brian Johnson, I ended the piece with this, but I think one of the things that struck him was that talking to his family made it better, but also that he waited so long to get help, that he suffered in silence for so long because he was afraid. He was afraid how his teammates would react.
Exactly.
He was afraid whether or not he would get a chance to be back on the mound. Brock worried, would my anxiety keep me from being a good baseball player? Is it just a concussion thing? Is it more? And I think both of them through therapy realized, hold on a second, I'm not alone here. Both of them kept saying that, you know, my situation isn't unique. Just because I'm an athlete doesn't mean that that I'm immune to this or anybody else is. And, you know, Brian said, for someone who's keeping this to themselves and not talking to someone about it, once you do talk about it, you're going to say to yourself, why did I wait so long? Why did it take me so long to seek help or get therapy? And I think part of why they talk about it, Jim, is not only to get people necessarily to talk about it publicly, because not everybody wants to talk about it publicly. It's a very personal issue, and it's a very vulnerable issue, because you're not, again, it's not just saying, oh, you know what, I was out running from first to second base and I tore a ligament, and this is the, you know, step one, two, and three I have to take through rehab to get back. You have to talk about some pretty deep, dark thoughts and feelings, and that's a little bit harder, but I think they feel that if by talking about it, even if someone doesn't talk about it publicly, if they say, wow, I've experienced that, and these two guys weren't afraid to go talk to a therapist or get on medication and get help, maybe somebody else won't either.
One last thing about this, though. Do they worry, and I don't just mean Holt and Johnson, the athletes with whom you've spoken, you did a program with Joe Kennedy, and I know a whole bunch of, we talked about that, and a whole bunch of athletes, some of whom are really, really prominent. Do they worry that when, because neither of them are Mookie Betts. I mean,
right.
Do they worry that when they're the 23rd, 24th, or 25th man on the team, that an employer is, and the Red Sox are a pretty enlightened crew when it comes to a lot of issues, they're going to say, well, they're not going to say it publicly, between Brock Holt and John Doe, John Doe is a more stable person, and who knows, there may be some mental health issues which may intercede here. Do they worry about the impact of that on their careers?
Both thought about that in the midst of it, but once they came forward and talked to the Red Sox, they tell me, like, there's a quote in the story where Brian Johnson says, you know, I don't give a bleep what you think about me. If you want to look at me and think differently of me because I have depression and I have anxiety and I have to take medication, that's a you problem, not a me problem. But both did say that when they were experiencing the issues, that was a fear of coming forward. Would I be accepted? Would I lose my spot on the team? And, you know, I have talked to athletes who have not spoken publicly because they are on, you know, the fringe end of making teams. They still have to go in on a minor league contract with an invite to big league camp, which means you're not guaranteed a spot on the 40-man roster. You're not guaranteed to break camp. And that is a real fear for them. There's also a fear for some of them who are going through personal issues that it's going to be brought up and used against them, so they keep it quiet. And those are the stigmas that I hope by talking about this, we continue to break down that, again, you know, and to be quite honest, I always try to correlate, why don't we treat physical health the same way we treat mental health? But if we're being honest, a player who has an injury history in any sport, doesn't matter what sport it is, you're looked at a little with some more trepidation whether or not to take you. So I understand that fear of if I come out and talk about this mental health issue, it may be seen the same as a physical issue. And they might go, I'm going to go with the guy who's more healthy and who might not have to miss time because of anxiety. We don't want to lose somebody for a stretch of time. So, yeah, it is. I think it is a real fear and why so many guys are hesitant to talk about it. I mean, it's one thing to be Kevin Love, right? It's one thing to be Kevin Love or DeMar DeRozan. For those of you who don't know, that is Kevin Love plays for the Cavaliers, DeMar DeRozan with the Toronto Raptors. Both were really open about their own mental health struggles, but a lot of guys don't talk about it until after they retire.
Isn't Kevin Love's uncle one of the original Beach Boys? Isn't he Mike Love is his
oh,
uncle?
I don't know.
I'm pretty
really?
Sure, by the way. I'm pretty sure that's right.
Good vibrations.
Can somebody check that? I think so. So can we go from praise to damnation?
Yeah.
Kareem Hunt, I think
it's always
most
a great spectrum
remember,
here.
Kicked a woman, was dropped by the Kansas City Chiefs.
After the video came out, though.
That is a very good point.
Knew about the incident prior to, and they said, oh, it was solved, and everything's fine, and he's come to terms with it. And then the video comes out, and they see how horrific it is. And then the Chiefs release him.
And then, so Cleveland picks him up. He just got an 8-game suspension. A former teammate, who, if I remember correctly, a couple of years ago, totally burnt the Patriots with like 3 touchdown catches when he was a rookie or something. Tyreek Hill, this one to me is otherworldly horrible. Can you describe what he is accused of what Hill is accused of doing and what's happening?
So this is a second accusation against Tyreek Hill. The accusation this time around, police were called twice to his home. I believe the dates were March 5th and again around March 13th or 14th. They were called to his home where his fiance, with his fiance and his 3-year-old son, the first time the police went to the home, they were like, shoot away. And they were like, oh, there's nothing to see here. The second time, they actually did file a complaint and filed charges against him for assault on his 3-year-old son to the point where he abused his 3-year-old son to the point of breaking his arm. This son is the same son who his now fiance was pregnant with in college when Tyreek Hill physically abused her. She is now pregnant with twins by him, and they are engaged, which I'm sure a lot of people are rolling their eyes and they're sitting in their car and saying, well, what the heck are you doing, lady? Why are you with this guy? He beat the snot out of you while you were pregnant with this young boy, and now he's beating this young child. And now you're pregnant with twins with this same man. And it's complicated is what I always say to people, because when you're with someone of this status and of this stature, even in college, it's scary to leave someone who threatens you physically, because if they're threatening you physically and they're acting out on that, many times they're also threatening you with further violence if you speak out against them, if you leave them. If you leave me and you file charges, I'll never make money, I'll never make anything of my life, I won't be able to have this career. There's a lot of emotional abuse that goes on. These women oftentimes fear for their lives, and it feels like a better alternative to stay than to go.
And by the way, let me just add a little bit to the thing in college when he assaulted and pled guilty, by the way, it's not an allegation, to domestic assault and battery by strangulation in August 2015. What I learned from you or
she
our
was
friend
pregnant. Okay.
Wendy Murphy and is strangulation is the first serious indicator that you're going to be dead at the hands of this man.
It's the last step before killing somebody.
Before killing. And so, you know, and I am a second chance kind of guy, big time, if you really want to fix yourself and you show contrition. If it is true that this guy, after the first incident, broke this little 3-year-old kid's arm, if the NFL does not ban this guy for life and say, after you've served your time, and I hope you do, go get a real job. This is unconscionable that this guy could ever be on a football field. He assaults this woman, strangles this woman, and then he breaks the arm of the 3-year-old child of this woman. It's unbelievable to me.
And the whole thing about that happened in college, after he pled guilty, he had to do community service.
Right,
he had
right.
to go through therapy. He had to go through a diversion program.
Worked
all
well.
Of these things. Yes. And you know what? If it works, okay, great. Then you get a second chance. But to me, if you've gone through that already and you do it again, what's keeping you now from handling the stress of going through this? handling the stress of now. He's probably the other interesting piece to this puzzle is the Kansas City Chiefs were on the verge of making him one of the highest paid wide receivers in the NFL. They were negotiating a contract extension for him because of the incident that happened in college. He was a clear shot to be a first round draft pick until this happened. He dropped, I believe, to the fourth or fifth round before Kansas City took him, which cost him a lot of money. Well, now Kansas City, because he had, you know, in their eyes, kept his nose clean, they were about to pay him a bundle of money. Well, he's not going to get that money now. I'm a little surprised that Kansas City has not already released him because they were very quick once the video came out to release Kareem Hunt. But again, there's no video here. And so it's like we're stuck in this loop, in this trap of, well, if I don't actually see it, I don't really know how bad it was. And maybe what he's telling me is right. And I haven't seen any further. I looked yesterday to see if there were any updates on this. But to the best of my knowledge, the fiance was once again a little hesitant to cooperate, probably being protective of him. Because now, again, she's pregnant with twins. She's the mother of this young son, and she doesn't have a job.
Do you remember the Ray Rice press conference where the woman he knocked out
they married
called? She's at the press conference defending him. We saw the video when they were engaged.
They got
where
married.
He literally knocked her out cold outside that
and
elevator.
And they got married.
Yeah.
It amazes me on an institutional level with these teams that there is not a better system in place. I mean, the 8 games for Kareem Hunt, that's great. But it, to me, if Tyreek Hill does not get banned for life, at the very least an indefinite suspension, the same as what they did with Josh Gordon, which is what Josh Gordon right now is serving for substance abuse issues. Keep in mind, he has harmed himself. He has harmed
exactly,
no one else.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm already at my wit's end with the NFL. And I will say this, Gary Tanguay, my colleague at NBC Sports Boston, suggested a really great a really great sort of pathway to maybe making this better. Because the point I brought up on our show was, you know, these women are so fearful to come forward. And part of what they're afraid of is how do they survive?
Of course.
You know, they might have gone to college, but if you married someone who got drafted right out of school and you go and you already have this million-dollar lifestyle and you don't work, how do you then go out and get a job and support yourself? Gary said that these guys should be fined exorbitant amounts and that money should go into a pool that then goes to the victims of domestic violence to get them to a shelter, to provide them with money so that they feel comfortable leaving. But I also put some of this on our law. I shouldn't say our law enforcement, because police officers aren't trained. So, you know, they're not social workers. They're not psychologists. When they go into this, they're going into it with a police officer's mindset, which is to defuse a situation and try to prevent further violence. But they're not trying to necessarily facilitate anything for the victim. And I've brought this up before, but in Iceland, if there is a domestic dispute, it's not just the police that go. It is a legal assistant and a social worker. So you have three prongs in place to help the victim navigate the system and feel that they're safe and they have somewhere else to go. And someone to actually really psychologically assess the situation, not just come in as, you know, someone who's trained, again, as a police officer, which is different than social work and
psychology.
Can we
stay on this one more second? You know, Reverend Emmett Price is one of the few people I know who actually puts his money where his mouth is.
It's incredible.
Played football, loves football, doesn't watch the NFL. It's a little bit about concussions, but I think he's told us it's pretty much about how they've handled the kneeling and that sort of thing. If you patronized the business on Boylston Street, Marjorie or Trenny, and you found out that the vice president the day before had broken the arm of his 3-year-old little boy, and another vice president who had worked there the year before had kicked and punched a woman, would you ever think of patronizing that business? No.
I would go elsewhere.
But does everybody continue to watch the NFL with these domestic and non-domestic abusers? The answer is the vast majority of us, without the exception of Emmett and others, do. We're pathetic. We are part of the problem.
I've said it before that every time a woman buys, you know, women who get all worked up about this and get so frustrated, when have we ever called on advertisers? When have we come together as a group and said, until this gets fixed, I am going to target your advertisers? Until we do it for Tucker Carlson, we do it for Jeanine Pirro on Fox News. You know, it happens all the time in other walks of life. Why do we not say to you know, Kansas City, whatever their, you know, I don't know if it's Sprint or whatever their biggest advertiser is, you know what? I'm going to boycott you and I am going to shame you into submission to pull your advertising from the NFL, from this team until things change. But we don't do it. And I don't know why we don't
do it. You know, that is a great point. We don't do it. And that does get action really quickly.
Right. Money. That's at the end of the day, we can be as angry on Twitter as we want about it. We can go on talk shows and, you know, a lot of hot air.
There's a high percentage of women who watch football that women are.
Yes.
Did we learn 40% from you or somebody last year?
I think it is like 40%. It's like 60-40 or, you know, 70-30, 65-35. Somewhere in there is the breakdown. Many women watch football. They play fantasy football. They buy tickets. They buy merchandise. You know, I have made the decision. I'm not going to play fantasy. Hold me to it. Do not let me when August rolls around and say, oh, but it's so fun. I'm not playing fantasy football this year. I paid for a ticket this year to go watch the Packers play the Patriots, but I don't think I'm going to do that. I think I'm just going to watch Patriots games because I have to, and then that's it with the NFL because, quite frankly, I'm fed up with it. I'm fed up with the way that they handle their African-American employees and the way that they treat their freedom of speech. I'm tired of them turning a blind eye to concussions, pumping money into youth football programs because they can see, especially youth football programs in inner cities, because they're losing affluent white communities. So now they're giving kids a way out. I'm finally getting around to reading Howard Bryant's
We had him on.
The
we
Heritage.
Wrote the book.
It's an unbelievable book, but it makes me really think of how we have conditioned African American kids to think their only way out is to play a sport, and that is unconscionable. That money should go back. You know what the NFL should do? Put that money back into schools so those kids can get an education. Yeah,
by the way,
I'm real angry.
Howard's
about
book
it.
Is about activism by African American athletes.
But he also
and
really,
non-activism by.
But he really also traces the sociological effects of and the economic effects of putting you know, African American communities in this, you know, in this hole, in this economic hole of feeling like our schools are bad, there's no way out, this is the only way out.
Do you think, in light of this discussion, it was good that Marjorie didn't wear her TB12 jersey today? Or
look at TB12 across
right
the street.
Right across the street.
Look at
him. We shouldn't look at him anymore.
Prepare.
Tom,
perform.
Yeah, Tom Brady is staring at me right
that
now.
That is one fine-looking
man. At least I like to think
he is an attractive-looking guy.
He is an attractive
And you know what? In fairness,
guy.
It's not his fault the NFL
I understand
is this
that.
Way. I mean, you know, there are grown-ups in the room. Not that Tom Brady's not a grown-up. He is. But there are people paid that are supposed to take care of this. But they're spineless, Roger Goodell. You are you are absolutely spineless.
But by the way,
while
it is
not
his fault, if people like him speak out against things like this, change will happen a lot faster than
And you know what? They don't even have to be that courageous. They could speak out after they've retired. You know, they could even be, you know, but a lot of famous.
But then it's real hard to work for one of the big networks get paid millions of dollars to work 16 or 18 weeks a year and keep making millions of dollars to talk about football on Sundays.
Well, that was really uplifting. Come back again soon, will you?
I will. I'll talk to you guys from Seattle next week. I'm going to Seattle for the Red Sox opening series. So I will talk to you from there. We can talk fish markets and. What a life.
I was just there last year.
Are?
Okay, fine. Goodbye.
Tony Kuznarek is an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. Coming up, the president of the Boston City Council, Andrea Campbell, joins us. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH. We're broadcasting from the Boston Public Library.
Coming up on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, is there anything the city could have done to prevent the abduction and murder of Jesse Correa? Can it do more to make sure that no one feels threatened when all they want is a night on the town? At noon, we talked to Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell about what needs to be done to reduce this kind of violence. And while the college admission scandal is exposing how so many kids are getting a free pass, is it time for Massachusetts to give them one? Literally. Should the MBTA and universities provide free public transportation? We'll ask the Globe's Shirley Leung about this and more.
The White House will get to see Mueller's report before Congress or the public. Will Mick Mulvaney and Kellyanne Conway be armed with bottles of Whiteout? Or will everyone have access to the entirety of Mueller's findings? We'll ask CNN's John King. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We're broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So earlier this month, Boston made national news for all the wrong reasons. The abduction and murder of 23-year-old Jesse Correa. What didn't make national news, maybe because it's a brand of violence that's all too common, the shooting death of 32-year-old Kendrick Price. Both of these acts of violence hit Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell close to home, not only because public safety is one of her top priorities, but because they both have ties to her district. City Council President Andrea Campbell, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here.
No, thank you. And I was actually at Mr. Price's funeral this weekend, so it's been a difficult time for folks in the district. But again, you know, I have a population of residents that are resilient and want to work as a collective to address these incidents of violence.
You know, we're going to get to that and go into some. I'm going to do a horrible transition, so let me apologize in advance if I can, because we do want to talk about this and your concern. I texted Marjorie during the St. Patrick's Day breakfast the other day, and I have to say, and I know a lot of those people, we do, and there are a lot of really nice people. It was pathetic. I mean, pathetic. And I can't believe I'm sitting there watching the whole damn thing. However, there's one exception.
Marjorie
will attest to this because I texted her about you. Mm-hmm. You had, I would argue, the line of the day. We attempted to get it, but it's not up online yet. So I'm going to ask you something that's probably unfair. Can you recreate your line about how you got to the event at the Flynn?
It was at a cruise port.
The Ray Boston Flynn, as in former mayor. Cruiseport. This is Andrea Campbell speaking at the event. Do you have that line? Can you do it for us?
Yeah. So I talked about getting there, and I said, you know, there's so much building and so many changes in the area. It's hard to know where you are these days in the city. But thankfully, Mayor Walsh has left a series of landmarks that helped me get my bearings. Let me read you my directions, courtesy of Google Maps. First, take a right at Olympic Stadium in Wyden Circle. Just make sure you don't confuse it with the MLS soccer stadium at Frontage Road. Then continue down the road until you reach GE's shiny new headquarters. But if you get to Amazon's HQ2, you've gone way too far, way too far. Turn around, drive back by the Seaport's IndyCar track for about a quarter mile. And voila, you're here. You're here.
And I loved it. And didn't you then go on to say it's clear the humor set sails years ago, so it was a good place to be doing it? You know, so how did standing.
That was all the stuff that you're going to get from the Olympics.
Of course.
I assume
not just the Olympics, but the soccer stadium was going to be all these things, the GE headquarters. So how did Mayor Walsh react to this?
He laughed.
A sincere laugh? I think so.
We'll find out. He said it was good, and Governor Baker thought it was good, and we had a good time.
Well, that's great. No, it was a good line, and otherwise.
Thank you.
So before we move ahead, raise your right hand and tell me what you really thought of the breakfast.
It was very serious. So before they got to me, I was like, maybe I should cut some of my jokes, you know, and make it lighter. But then it's like, it's supposed to be fun. I thought Senator Collins did a really good job. It's not easy hosting that breakfast.
Well, let me just say this. He's a really nice guy. Let's put it that way. Can we leave it?
The venue was really nice. And, you know, it's an opportunity to celebrate Evacuation Day and St. Patrick's Day and folks in the Irish community. And that's important, obviously, in the city of Boston. I know that, born and raised here. It's important. So it was a good time.
Okay. That was diplomatic. I'm sorry. You raised a really important issue, and I'm sorry we jumped. So let's get back to it.
Let's get back to a really much more upsetting situation. You mentioned before that you went to Kendrick Price's funeral. Tell people a little bit about who he was and what happened to him.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's a young man that just actually got hired as a coach at UMass. And apparently, I mean, I'm still learning more about this, too, but apparently was at a party or something like that and looking to break something up and get shot and killed. And it's always difficult and challenging. And I think, you know, a lot of these incidents or violence are concentrated in certain neighborhoods, Dorchester and Mattapan. And I live in Mattapan, and I represent District 4, and those are my two biggest neighborhoods. So we have a lot of work to do in order to not have these incidents continue to show up. And what is that? It's root cause stuff. You know, it's making sure that folks have good jobs, good schools, people have access to opportunity. We have to close wealth gaps. A lot of these neighborhoods have been under-resourced and underserved for a really long time. And we just have to do more to address incidents of public safety.
Can we talk about this Jesse Correa thing? Willie Gross, the commissioner, is going to be with us on Friday, I believe. Is that right, Chelsea, this Friday? He'll be with us for an hour at the library to answer our questions and obviously the audience's questions as well. He called a meeting of bar owners and bar leaders, et cetera, I think it was Tuesday night of last week, an attempt to come up with a strategy for women who are just wanting to have fun in their lives and all of a sudden put their lives at great risk. One, what came out of that as far as you know? And two, what can and should be done so that what can and should be done?
Yeah, I mean, so I didn't attend that. I actually was holding a hearing related to another public safety issue, which is being able to walk and cycle in the community safely in the city of Boston. So I was having a hearing on how we improve in enforcement with respect to our traffic.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, too.
And speeding cars. So it conflicted. But that being said, Councilor Flynn and I did file a hearing order last year. We actually refiled it earlier in this year to look at issues of domestic violence, sexual assault. The sad reality is women don't feel safe. And you should be able to go out in the city of Boston, have a good time, hang out with your girlfriends, and not be in fear of your life or that you're going to be attacked. And so we filed this early on because we saw that this is an issue, sexual assault, domestic violence, in communities of color, in immigrant communities. We don't think the reporting is really reflective of the magnitude of the problem. So the question we're going to ask at this conversation is, what can the city of Boston do better with respect to addressing these issues? We will pull in this accountability piece around bar owners and invite them to be a part of the conversation. But that's just one piece of a larger issue of violence against women that we often don't talk about. Even when we talk about crime going down in the city of Boston, if you pull that apart, that's not necessarily the case when it comes to incidents of domestic violence and sexual assault. So we're going to do something in partnership with Northeastern and their domestic violence clinic and institute there, and have a series of conversations. Often people come together, they wear white ribbons, and they do this one-day event. We said, no, we need to do more than that. So we're going to work with the advocates and those who are leading these incredible organizations to say, how do we move the needle forward with respect to these issues? And one piece might be not just the reporting piece and enforcement. Housing, if you're in a domestic violence situation, it can be really challenging to get out in terms of housing. So there are multi different layers, but our goal is to have one conversation, talk about the problem, and then to get to actual solutions.
I'm going to add one thing to your list, which is the most difficult solution, but ultimately the only one, I think, and I'm not belittling all the others. Jhené Osterhout, who I met for the first time the other night on television, is brilliant.
She's a great columnist
for the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
Wrote a piece about, you know, you got to text your friends when you get to all these things. But, and I'm putting words in your mouth, you shouldn't have to. Men should act responsibly. And obviously that is the goal. But the problem I had, Gina Scaramella, who obviously works on these issues, and Jhené were with me the other night. How do you do that? How do you change the culture? And while we're changing the culture or attempting to change the culture, how do you protect people? What are the stopgap measures before we figure out how men act like respectful human
beings? Yeah, I mean,
I
want to give kudos to the commissioner. He has an incredibly difficult job. He's taking on this issue. Our new Suffolk County District Attorney, Rachel Rollins, same thing.
She's on TV with me tonight,
but it's about,
though,
you know,
say.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. But it's about, like you said,
moment.
Shifting culture. So whether it's getting our men not to attack women or issues around race and racism, we have to be intentional around whether it's training, conversation, inviting folks in. Frankly, a lot of conversations we show up in the domestic violence space or sexual assault space, it's just women in the room. I'm so proud to do this in partnership with Councilor Flynn. And if people don't know him, he's a white male representing a large district, including Chinatown. And when he was campaigning, issues of domestic violence came up, and he says, I want to do something about it. I think there's tremendous power in expanding the who is a part of these conversations. You know, men can hold men accountable. And when I call out and say, men, stop attacking women, some people call me and say, stop saying that. Someone has to name it. But if you named it, it's a good thing.
You know, Andrea Kemp, I want to add one. I've said this before on the air. When I was a city councilor, which was a long time ago, it was not quite as an illustrious a term as yours has been, of course. I went to this meeting that I had no desire to go to, but I went because I thought a lot of parents are going to be there and I'd look bad if I didn't. I really had no interest, and I'm embarrassed to admit that. It was about the STARS program at Cambridge Ringe in Latin, and what it was about, domestic dating violence amongst teens. And again, I care about the issue, but I was going to blow it off. I didn't. It's one of the best things I've ever been to in my life because it was young men and women who had either perpetrated or been the survivors of dating violence. So it wasn't some 40-year-old white guy from the suburbs talking about mm-hmm. what you should be doing, but your peers talking about what they did. That and it was spectacular. I mean, it was one of the most impressive 90 minutes I've ever seen in my life. Do we have programs? I mean, getting kids young. Do we have programs like that in Boston public schools to deal with those? I don't know if it's a STARS program, but something.
No, I think so. And I think, you know, each school may show up a little differently in the space. But I think you're getting to a larger point, which is whether it is sexual assault, domestic violence, sexting, which is a big issue that we hear from our students, race or racism. Everyone has to be at the table. When we do our public safety work, we had someone say, you know, his name is Christian White, and he said, it's important that we also have those who, whether it's we label them as perpetrators, gang involved in the life, also be at the table and a part of the conversation because they, too, have solutions. So the same thing with domestic violence, sexual assault. I just got incredible funding to bring the Boston City Council through a racial equity training. And it's not just going to be the women or folks of color participating. All of us will participate mm-hmm. in that because there's something to be learned from each other. And we can't make a change or effectuate change or policy change if we don't do it as a collective. We just have to create the space. So I just really wanted to name that partnership with Councillor Flynn is really phenomenal because we need men showing up, too, to call this stuff out.
And, you know, you can't help but point out, too, that in this Olivia Ambrose case, she was the woman who went missing in January. She was coming home from a bar, and she wound up, and they were able to track her through cameras and a phone in the apartment of a guy in Charlestown who had exhibited all sorts of bizarre behavior. And we always talk about, it drives me a little nuts when people that say in these gun shootings and stuff, a lot of these shooters have mental health issues. But we never deal with the mental health issues. So, and that's very expensive to deal with the mental health issues. And that's got to be a piece of it, too.
I mean, it's more expensive. It's more long term. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no quick fixes here. We often, in government at least, want to have a quick fix, you know, and move on to the next issue. These are cultures and systems that we have to change. That requires a lot of work and intentionality. And so I think I'm always focused on that system level. How do we actually shift systems and culture so that we show up differently in the work?
So you mentioned traffic enforcement a minute ago. Now, I'm standing here with somebody who opposes the mayor's proposal to lower the speed limit 20 miles an hour. Do you, by the way?
I've said previous, we lowered it to 25 miles per hour, but I said that is useless if we are not coupling that with increased enforcement, if we are not funding BPD adequately for them to actually do their jobs. Just had a hearing on this.
What does that mean, do their job?
There are 11 police districts. Just had a hearing on this. 11 police districts. There is one officer doing traffic enforcement for all of those for each of those districts. We have large communities. My district alone is huge. And to have one person doing traffic enforcement for speeding cars, that's
wait a minute,
not enough.
Wait a minute. For the all 11 districts?
No,
is
one per
district.
Okay, I was going to say, that's insane.
One per district. But that's not enough.
Yeah.
And so how do we augment or expand their capacity? But one thing that also came up was the need for better data, so that they can actually be more targeted in their response in enforcement. There's no traffic analyst. So we can fund that in our budget. I say let's do it. But in addition to enforcement, lowering the speed limit, we need to invest more in slow streets, which gives us speed humps and other structural changes to the street. And then lastly, we need to increase ridership on other modes of transportation. So the T, a bike, something else. There's a lot of cars. All of this has to happen at the same time. Instead, I think we're focusing on one thing instead of doing it comprehensively. And that's the problem. So the hearing really focused on how do we tackle all four of those. And I'll give you one example on increasing ridership. Blue Hill Ave in my district. How do we actually get more folks on the bus, on the T? And we have to have a conversation about whether it's rapid transit or dedicated bus lane on Blue Hill Ave. We've been talking about it for years. It's like, let's stop talking. Let's get to doing. So that's something I really want to tackle with the administration to say, how do we get that done? Because that, too, helps with traffic, congestion, speeding cars, all of that.
Is it, you know, when you talk about, I think we're talking, you and I are talking about two different kinds of traffic enforcement. We've had this discussion with the mayor. We've had this discussion with both Commissioner Evans. I don't know if we've had it yet with Commissioner Gross. I think one of the problems is the cops are not tough enough on cyclists, drivers, and pedestrians when they're violating the law. I mean, I mentioned last night, who was here? Mayor Walsh was here a week ago Friday, mm-hmm. a morning after I had on my 12-minute drive home from WGBH to Inman Square, Cambridge, where I literally almost killed two cyclists because they not only ran the red light, but because after running the red light, swerved right in front of me, and if I had looked down for a split second, one or both would have been dead. In Central, this is not Boston, but I see it here too. I'm in Central Square every single night. There are people taking illegal left turns, holding up traffic, 20 cars back when there's a huge sign. They never get arrested. Why isn't there an emphasis? I know we don't like over-policing, but why isn't there an emphasis on holding people accountable for violating traffic laws that put other people at risk?
Absolutely.
And maybe they won't do the behavior again. Even, not because they have some ethical or moral opposition, but because they don't want to get caught. Why isn't that at the top of the list?
So I think it was, and it was a part of the conversation we had. So we had Councillor Edwards, for example, who represents Charlestown, East Boston, talk about block the box. She says, I can sit there, people are blocking the box,
Walsh meant this
and
too.
No one is enforcing. We need to enforce here.
I agree.
Sometimes the police officers are, but then they're also like, we get there too late because there's not enough of us. And so we heard that loud and clear. They need more human capital to be able to do this work well. In addition, I think, you know, we could talk about if they're using their discretion too much. I don't think that's the case. What came out of that hearing is they need more resources, they need more supports to be able to do this. And so in the next budget round, we need to make sure that we're investing in that so that they can do better enforcement and hopefully make our lives all a lot better.
We're talking about Andrea Campbell, president of Boston City Council. I'm sorry, yes.
No, one thing I'll add is we had folks testify, too, to talk about creating more of a sense of urgency around these issues. You know, there was a gentleman who testified he had just come back from New York, and he felt like walking down the street in New York was safer than walking here. And they have all kind of different enforcement tools. And we had an ER doctor who was an ER doctor at BMC who also suffered an accident when she was riding her bike to work, who said, you know, you get folks to respond for street cleaning quicker. Towing cars is a process, a routine. And yet the same response doesn't seem to exist if someone's getting hit on their bike or walking down the street. So that sense of urgency is there. We have to respond to it adequately.
Speaking of sense of urgency, you had a great piece in the Globe talking